go into fight or flight. We go into what we call the tend and befriend phenomenon. We want to turn inward. We want to nurture. We want to focus on our friends and family. We want to cuddle, but we don't want to have sex. Now, if you think about it from an evolutionary perspective, they talk about the fight or flight response in terms of the caveman who was fighting off the saber-toothed tiger. With tend and befriend, the women would go into the back of the cave and protect their children while the man fought off the tiger. SS. What happens when you have chronic stress? LB. There is a rise in oxytocin levels, which is our chemical of attachment. It is what we release from our breastfeeding. As our oxytocin levels go up, it creates a chain reaction that decreases the amount of free testosterone we have in our bodies. SS. So that stress indirectly affects our testosterone production as well. LB. Yes, but when you're thinking about younger women, the reason for a sexual drop-off is more often related to childbirth or chronic stress and depression than anything else. Of course, there are all the other emotional and relationship reasons, the most obvious being that your relationship is stressful, or your relationship isn't what you thought it would be, or your partner has gotten lazy, or you have gotten lazy, or you are too busy with the kids and work and everything else, and sleep is better than sex. All of those excuses are very real, but what I think creates a cascade of low desire is that women lose themselves, very often starting in their 30s, and become outwardly focused. One of the great things about aging is that when our kids leave home, we can really start to define and refine ourselves, and we can reach a sense of centeredness that we don't have when we're younger. Most young women start focusing so much attention on their family, managing their home, managing their kids' 40 different after-school activities, cleaning the house, and all the things that they have to do that they lose sight of themselves in the process. In losing sight of ourselves, assuming there aren't other physiological factors, we tend to lose sight of our sensuality, our sexuality, and our energy. And we really don't take care of ourselves. We've been hung on by our kids all day long. We're stressed out. We see our partner at the end of the day, or we have been working all day and struggling to make ends meet, come home, and the last thing we feel like doing is having sex. It feels like another chore. SS. That's interesting because I interviewed a group of young working mothers, middle to late 30s, and they did refer to sex as the dirty little chore. LB. Yes, that is what they see it as, another chore they have to do, and their partners pick up on that. I try to counsel women and couples that they need to understand that it becomes a self-fulfilling negative cycle. As women lose interest in sex for very real reasons, they're overworked and overtired, or there may be a hormonal or another physiological reason, they forget that for men, the number one vehicle by which they achieve a sense of intimacy and connection to their partner is through being sexual. What happens when men are not getting sex? Is that they just inadvertently feel less close to their partner and less intimate. Therefore, they act in a less intimate and less connected way, even unconsciously. They're not doing it on purpose, but they don't think about doing the little things that mean so much to the woman. SS. And then I suppose she becomes resentful or angry that he's not as close to her. LB. Right, and when he complains about not having sex, she says, "All you care about is sex. And now you're not going to be romantic with me unless I have sex with you." Then she blames him for thinking only about sex when in reality, the reason he's thinking about sex is not only because he wants to be sexual and because he has the desire, but because he also wants to be close to her. SS. Then what happens? LB. He feels less close to her. He's less connected. He's less intimate. And because women are in large part inspired to be sexual because they feel close to their partners, she then shuts down even more sexually and it becomes a vicious circle. SS. I'm exhausted listening to the cycle. As you were explaining, I wanted to say, stop, don't you see what's happening? LB. Sex feels like the dirty little chore for two reasons. One, because the woman is exhausted and it starts to feel like one more thing she has to do, and two, because she doesn't have the emotional and romantic context in her relationship to experience it as something pleasurable and loving and connecting. I don't think it starts out as a dirty little chore. I think it becomes a dirty little chore when the relationship begins to break down. SS. Do you think that this is all part of the superwoman's desire to be perfect in everything she does, that she's lost sight of what's important? LB. Yes. The quintessential modern woman has a career, a family, a beautiful home, and all of the material possessions she wants. In her spare time, she gives back to the community and joins committee forums or alliances or whatever it is that she's interested in doing. SS. So where in the world is she? Where is her center? Where is her identity? LB. Everything she's doing is outwardly focused either on how she is perceived by others or on giving back to the community or to her family. Even exercise and nutrition for herself are more often about wanting to maintain a certain appearance than on enhancing herself, loving her body, or caring for her body. It is an outward focus, not an inward one. SS. In speaking with women, I discovered that children are now sleeping in their parents' bed way too long. They are ages 3, 4, 5, 6 and older and still in their parents' bed. LB. Yes, that is a big issue. Where there's a will, there's a way to get the child out of that bed, unless it is a family who has a serious intellectual or emotional commitment to the family bed and believes that children should sleep with their parents as they grow up. But in families who are miserable, suffering with the child still in their bed, I look at that couple and wonder what purpose this child is serving. Usually, one or both of them are relieved that the child is still in the bed and use the fact that the child is there as a way to avoid intimacy and sexual connection. SS. But what about putting locks on the doors and having rules? LB. They say they worry they're not going to hear the child, or they worry there'll be an emergency, or they worry that an older kid might try to get into the room and see that it is locked and, God forbid, know what they're doing. They don't understand that the biggest gift they can give to their children is being open about the fact that mommy and daddy have an intimate relationship that is separate from the kids, and that they deserve privacy, and that their privacy needs to be respected. SS. Where do you see this group down the road? LB. Well, I think these women run a risk. It can go in two directions. More often than not, as a woman starts to reach 40 and 50, she goes through a life crisis. Maybe her husband is cheating on her, or maybe it is a child getting sick, or the child leaving for college, or a friend getting sick. Sometimes it's the woman herself getting sick. But something happens that will be a reality check to her. Most often, it is going through perimenopause. She'll start to reorient herself and begin to turn inward a bit more and start to take care of her emotional self and her soul. But the problem is that these women run the risk of losing their partners, because as they start to go into this next passage, if the relationship has already started to disintegrate, they run the risk not only of the marriage falling apart, but also of the husband being more vulnerable to opportunities for infidelity, even if he's not seeking them out. SS. So because he's starved for that emotional and sexual connection, he's much more vulnerable to other women. LB. Yes, and these women want to give the connection to him. SS. So let's go on to the next group of women who are my age, in their middle 50s, and in menopause. So many I've talked with are experiencing a lack of sexual feeling and no clitoral feeling, as though they're dead from the waist down. How much of this are you seeing? LB. A lot of women come in complaining about this, and part of the problem is testosterone. SS. Are you talking free testosterone? LB. Free testosterone and testosterone in general. We have found that there are androgen receptors and genital sensation. When women have low testosterone, one of the signs, of course, is low libido, but it goes hand in hand with low genital sensation, low energy, and a low general sense of well-being. So we did sensory testing and found that women with low testosterone also had sensory impairment when we did sensory testing on their genitals. SS. What causes the impairment? LB. We don't know. We think it is because there are androgen receptors in the genital tissue, but we don't know what role they play. Is it for sensation? Or does testosterone play a role in the nerve receptors so that nerve receptors without testosterone become atrophied? Because even when you replace testosterone, the sensation doesn't always improve as much as you would like. So, is it because the nerve receptors have atrophied too long and they can't be resurged or revitalized? SS. Can they? LB. We only have our own anecdotal clinical experiences, but we have found that for women with low genital sensation and low testosterone, replacing their testosterone sometimes improves their sensation. Topical testosterone on the genital area or some other blood enhancers also seem to improve the sensation. The theory is that the increased blood flow pushes the nerve receptors closer to the surface of the skin, which makes them feel sensation better. So that is where Viagra and some of the other vasodilators have a role. SS. Is there one perfect hormonal cocktail for every woman? LB. No. Every woman is different, so every woman has to find her perfect balance with the help of her doctor. It requires that the patient and the doctor work together as never before. What is likely is that as women go into menopause, with the help of their doctor, they will devise the appropriate hormonal cocktail, which will hopefully include testosterone. Then, as needed, they can augment that with other medications, whether it be Viagra, one of the new incarnations of Viagra that are coming on the market, or some of the other arousal-enhancing agents that are out there. SS. But Viagra does not put you in the mood, does it? LB. No, it improves genital sensation for women. You also have to be careful with hormones. Too much is not good, nor is too little. Testosterone gel or cream does get minimally absorbed into the system. SS. But there are signs from using too much. Facial hair, pimples, oily skin. LB. Yes, so you'll know if you're using too much. But testosterone creams and gels are also good for genital pain. We alternate with estrogen cream and testosterone cream because testosterone helps to toughen up the tissue as well as increase the sensation. There are other things to help you also, like androgel. SS. Can you give a list of what's available? Women are so reluctant to talk about this, but I know they're going to love reading about it. LB. A good place to go is my website, www.bermancenter.com. Androgel is approved right now for men. It is a gel that is applied on a non-hairy part of the body. We use androgel as a last resort if the woman is not responding well to oral testosterone or testosterone cream. But this medication is not dosed for women. It's not easy for us to use yet, and it's only available as an off-label prescription. SS. Why are there no sexual medications for women? LB. Until several years ago, women were not allowed to be included in any clinical trials. SS. Why? Are our genitals not as important? LB. It's just the way it has been, but things are changing. Women are involved with drug companies, so I believe in the next 3 to 5 years we're going to see a whole array of options that will enhance sexuality for women. SS. Well, I hope so. Before I started to write this book, I always wondered why middle-aged men leave their middle-aged wives. It's not that they don't look great. I believe that as we go through the drastic changes of hormone loss, we behave badly because our chemicals are out of whack. We can't sleep, we're hot and then cold, we're tired all the time, we have strange itches, we break out in embarrassing sweats, we're bitchy and we lose our sex drive. So after a while, a man is going to say, "Who needs this?" and go out and find the new improved younger version of you. LB. Right, but it's not so much of who needs this as something more subtle. Even with the nicest guys, their sense of self-esteem, their virility, their sense of masculinity, and their sense of attractiveness are all deeply tied to the women they love. So when they feel rejected, over time they just get more and more resentful. The majority of times when men have an affair, it has very little to do with the sex. When a man is not having sex with his loved partner, it's because he's not feeling intimately connected with her, or appreciated, or loved, or attractive, or wanted, or desirable, or powerful, or any of those things he needs to feel good about himself. So if his self-esteem starts to dwindle, and then when he's at work or with his friends, an attractive woman starts treating him as someone who is attractive and virile and powerful and whatever else, a part of him starts to wake back up. SS. If the last resort for women is androgel, Is it possible to bring a woman back to sexual life? Or once you lose it, it's gone forever? LB. No, it's not gone. We have huge successes. The best success comes from a combined approach of medical treatment and talk therapy. SS. Like what? LB. Imagine a scenario where I'm talking to a perimenopausal or menopausal woman, and for medical reasons, she's lost interest in sex, and the negative cycle we've been talking about exists. This condition affects the woman's self-esteem also. It affects the way she feels about herself, her body, her partner, and her relationship. Maybe there's been a rift that has been building in the relationship. So talk therapy helps the couple, even if it is just getting over the awkwardness of trying to reconnect sexually. Between medication and talk therapy, I would say that we have an 80% success rate helping women who come to us complaining of low or no desire. SS. Tell me about your clinic. LB. I'm starting a new clinic in Chicago offering not only medical treatment but therapy as well, which means evaluating the couple's psychosexual history so that we can get a sense of the relationship and anything that could be contributing to the problem now and in the past. SS. Do you see them as a couple? LB. We see the woman first individually. We spend around 45 minutes with her. Then we see them as a couple for another 25 minutes. They can come back for more couple sessions if necessary, but meeting them together helps us see what is going on with the couple, especially the man. This kind of therapy helps get both partners on the same page, and it helps alleviate some of the self-blame and mutual blame that they are putting on each other. The center is not only going to have ongoing individual and couples therapy as needed, but we will also have group couples, educational seminars, and physical therapy so that when women have pain or atrophy in their genitals, we'll be able to offer physical therapy to help them. We're also giving Pilates and yoga classes for strengthening pelvic floor strength. Pelvic floor strength is central to women's sexual function and starts to decline as we have children and then continues to decline. But pelvic strength is central, not only to the woman's pleasure, but to her partner's as well. Yoga and Pilates also give women an opportunity, as I was talking about earlier, to reconnect with their bodies. SS. Well, I hate to be commercial, but that is a great use for the Thighmaster. One of its big benefits is its ability to strengthen the pelvic muscles. LB. You know, you're right. I think I'll start giving them out at the clinic. SS. Let me ask you, aren't people embarrassed to go to a sex therapist? LB. Well, it is a huge step for a couple to admit that they need therapy. But you would be surprised how many men call and want to make appointments for their wives. And men are so relieved that there is help available and that they're not going to be telling them that this is all in their heads. We say to them, let's find out what's going on. Let's look at the whole woman and see all the factors that could be contributing to her problem, the medical factors, hormonal as well as blood flow, and anything else that might be contributing from her surgical history, her past history, or any medications that she's on. We also look at her earlier sexual development, any trauma history she may have had, the messages she got about sex when she was growing up, how she feels about her body, how she feels about herself, how she's able to advocate for her sexual needs, whether she understands her body and how it works, what is happening in the relationship, what the level of communication and intimacy is, what the level of romance is, and what the level of affection is, because that is the thing that starts to go when the sex goes. They're not affectionate with each other anymore, and there are hurt feelings that need to be dealt with. You see, we can pump a woman full of all the hormones she needs, but if she's not feeling safe with her partner or connected to her partner, she's not going to be successful in her sex life. SS. I have to say, I never knew that a sex therapist existed until I read your book. LB. I've been working very hard to educate physicians, in particular gynecologists, because they seem to be the ones who hear a woman say, as she's walking out the door, oh, by the way, I haven't wanted to have sex for over a year. So part of my work is collaborating with the doctors to effectively deal with women with their physical issues as well. The perfect balance is to have a sex therapist and a medical practitioner who specializes in this, and that's not easy to find. SS. Where do we go if this is what we're looking for? LB. There's my sister's clinic at UCLA, Dr. Jennifer Berman. There's the clinic I'm opening in Chicago. And here and there, there are some doctors who have sex therapists working with them. Not many, but they do exist. SS. As I keep telling my readers, this passage takes handling. It is really up to each woman to find the help she needs, even if it means she has to drive long distances or fly somewhere. It's crucial to her well-being, her longevity, and her happiness. If a woman isn't willing to find the care she needs for herself, then she's going to end up taking an antidepressant to deal with her sexual dysfunction. LB. Right, and with the antidepressant, her sexuality isn't helped, but she doesn't care. Then the antidepressant makes her sexual dysfunction worse. I don't understand it. There have been studies that verify antidepressants do not help with PMS and menopausal symptoms. SS. Yes, and it seems like prescribing a Band-Aid to me. LB. Yes, it is a Band-Aid. When someone is suicidal or unable to function, then there's a role for antidepressants. But the problem is that the primary prescribers of antidepressants are now primary care physicians. They're not doing any extensive evaluation or providing ongoing therapy to get to the core of why the woman's depressed. They're just putting a Band-Aid on it. When women have sexual problems, where there may be very real emotional or physical causes, I say, okay. But antidepressants are not always the answer. SS. What needs to change relative to medical training? LB. There is very little education about how to talk to patients about sex and about sexual medicine in general. SS. Yet what makes the world go round? LB. I know, it's very, very sad. Doctors don't get the education, plus our society is litigious, and because of this, many doctors have told me that they're afraid to even ask a woman about her sexual function because she may think he's sexually harassing her, or she may think it's inappropriate. SS. Are you able to work with other doctors regarding this? LB. I have to find ways for them to indirectly open the doors so the patient can bring it up. But the other problem is managed care. A doctor has 15 minutes to conduct the entire visit. So how can you open up that Pandora's box? Because even if it's a physical problem and it's causing her tremendous distress and it's the first and only time she has the courage to bring up that her husband is disconnected from her and she's upset and now she's crying, doctors don't want to open that up when they have 20 patients waiting. SS. So what's the remedy? LB. We have this course called Women's Sexual Health State of the Art Series. This year we had about 300 people, mostly healthcare professionals, and our goal was to educate them about sexual medicine and how to get comfortable talking about sex, how to take a sex history, how to know whether a patient's a good candidate for medical intervention or better suited for therapy. Things they should be taught in medical school. I also encourage doctors to visit our website because it is intended not only for lay people, but for doctors and professionals too. This is working very well for us because it gives doctors a place to sort of pawn it off and not have to deal with it. SS. How long can a woman remain sexual? LB. Forever. There's no reason a woman should not be able to remain sexual. Plus, sex will keep her healthy. Sex is one of the major things that keep us connected to ourselves. A woman who has a happy, healthy sex life feels happier in general, feels more feminine, more attractive and aware and connected to her body, which will allow her to be more aware when things go wrong with her body. You can be physically intimate and physically connected and even orgasmic until you die. I have a patient who's 93 years old. About 5 or 6 years ago, I mentioned something about masturbation, and she said, "Oh, I never do that." And I said, why not? Her husband had died when she was in her 60s, and she hadn't been with another man since. Oh, I wouldn't even know what to do, she said. So I said, all right, I'm going to send you some stuff. I sent her a tiny purple vibrator, her favorite color is purple, and I included some diagrams showing her how to use it. A few weeks later, she said to me, you know that thing you sent me? It was a little small, don't you think? So I gave her a bigger one. A couple of months later, she mentioned that she had a second vacation home that she was going to, and she asked if I could send one to her there also. SS. So she's liking it and she's having fun. But for most people, buying a vibrator must be a very embarrassing thing. Where does one buy one? LB. That's a good point. There are lots of options online. There's one site called www.grandopening.com and another one called www.goodvibes.com. Both of them are oriented toward women. Good Vibes, which is really Good Vibrations, is in San Francisco, and the cool thing is that they send orders in an unmarked package. It just says Open Enterprises or something. If you don't order from them in a couple of months, they drop you from their mailing list. The top site right now is www.drugstore.com. SS. What role can a vibrator play? LB. It plays more of a role than people imagine. As we start to age, sex gets harder for women, and they think of it as some sort of failure, as do men. My job is to ask or encourage them to include a vibrator in their sex life. It can be very beneficial. There's a whole range of vibrators that are very small. Some can actually fit between people and can be incorporated into sex. Or a woman can have her clitoris stimulated to get things going. And those women who complain of feeling numb are able to jumpstart their sexual feelings with clitoral stimulation from a vibrator, even with testosterone cream or capsules or some of these other vasodilators or blood flow-enhancing agents, a vibrator can also help. Sometimes we need more sensation and more stimulation than when we were younger. SS. So, do you give a prescription for a vibrator? LB. I do. When I'm with a woman, we go over everything that's gone wrong and everything that's working and not working. Then I divide the treatment plan, which includes Kegels. But along with the other treatments, I write down what vibrator I think would work for her and what books and videos. SS. Which videos and which books? LB. There's a range. It depends upon what her issues are. If it's that her partner doesn't know how to stimulate her and she doesn't quite know how to tell him, then we talk about books on sexual technique. If she feels sort of awkward because she was a virgin when she got married and doesn't really know how to pump things up, I may introduce her to books and videos on erotic massage or on spicing up her love life or things like that. If she's never tried self-stimulation, I might introduce her to a standard plug-in vibrator. If she can have an orgasm on her own but needs extra clitoral stimulation and can't have it during intercourse, then I recommend a smaller vibrator. There are different brands. SS. Is there a G-spot? LB. I certainly think so. There's a lot of controversy about what the G-spot actually is. SS. It's on the inside wall directly behind the clitoris, isn't it? LB. Yes, and many believe that the two are intricately connected. Many people don't realize it, but the clitoris goes up 10 centimeters inside. It branches out to where the pubic bone is located. So it actually has two arms that go way back inside the body. It's not only that external button you see. Often the G-spot is where the Skene's glands are in a woman, which is analogous to the prostate gland in the man. SS. So are there vaginal orgasms as well? LB. Definitely. Most women will report that vaginal orgasms are much more intense. They include pelvic floor and uterine contractions, and they feel much deeper than a clitoral orgasm. But what I tell people is that an orgasm is an orgasm is an orgasm. It doesn't matter. The majority of women do not reach G-spot orgasm. But I think Kegel strength has a lot to do with it. SS. What part does a religious upbringing play in all of this? LB. Religious interpretation is so often sex negative, that sex is bad. A lot of women and men have been raised in an environment where their religious leaders told them they had to wait to be married before they had sex. This communicated that sex was wrong or bad or dirty. Masturbation was wrong, as was anything that could lead to a sexual energy or motivation because it might make you want to have sex before marriage. So these women have grown up with all these negative messages about touching themselves, about sexual pleasure, and about exploring sexuality, even with themselves. Then it's expected that on their wedding night, they're just going to turn on a light switch and become a sexual being. Those messages, which basically have been the entire nature of their sexual development, are really difficult to turn off. SS. What about childhood abuse? And I don't mean just sexual abuse. LB. Anything that interferes with our development, our sense of being in control, our pride in our bodies, our pride in our accomplishments, or anything that interferes with the development of positive self-esteem and our ability to trust and make ourselves vulnerable, can negatively impact our sexual lives. So if there is emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse of any sort, it will interfere with the child's sense of self, self-esteem, and body image, and her sense of control and sexual development. Without that sense of self, she doesn't have the ability to enjoy sex and respond sexually. SS: Do you think sex should be taught? LB: Absolutely. I create sex education programs, not only for kids, but for parents, too, to teach them how to raise their children to be sexually healthy. In reality, sex education starts at birth, just with touch and sensuality. There are so many things you can do for your children. Massaging your babies and helping them develop a sense of sensory awareness by encouraging them throughout their lives, praising them and encouraging them to have a sense of pride and joy in their bodies. Allowing and not repressing their desire to explore themselves sexually. Not slapping their hands and telling them that masturbation is bad. You may need to guide them to where it's okay to masturbate. You know, if you have company, then it's a good time to tell them, I know it feels good and it's fine to do, but it's really something you do in private. SS: Where would you like to see people's attitudes about sexual therapists, about women and sexuality, go? LB: I think women need a stronger sense of entitlement so that they feel they deserve a sexual response. It's worth seeking answers for. It has to be okay to seek help. In fact, seeking help has to become a good thing. Women have to realize they deserve to enjoy sex, and it doesn't mean that you're a harlot or that something is wrong with you. It has to be okay to admit that sexual enjoyment is missing from your life and you want to do something about it. In the beginning, when we first started this treatment, women would be cringing when they came in. I can't believe I'm coming to a doctor's office about this. They were embarrassed that they were placing so much importance on their sexuality that they were actually seeing a specialist about it. But I'm starting to see a shift. Women are coming in now and saying, you know what, there's help available and I'm going to take advantage of it. I would like to see more and more women feeling entitled to their sexual response and acknowledging that sexual response is a basic part of their general health and wellness. They have to stick to their guns when their doctors shuffle them around, or when somebody tells them that this is all in their head or that this is not a big deal. I would like to see women hold on to themselves and find themselves. In order to do that, you need to keep yourself grounded against all the other pressures. Women have to be motivated and proactive right now. But in the future, I'd like to see it come to a place where women don't have to be so intensely tenacious and motivated in order to get help. SS: I guess at this moment it is necessary for women to be highly motivated. Motivation can save a marriage. LB: Right? SS: I believe the work that you're doing will save marriages and families. LB: I believe that it already has. It's very rewarding. If this center proves successful, we plan to open more in other major cities. But right now, women have to be proactive. They have to do research, fight with their doctors, and keep asking the same questions again and again and again. SS: This has been very enlightening. I always thought that sexual dysfunction was the domain of menopausal women. I had no idea how pervasive it is. But this generation is an amazing group of women. We are the women who came into our young adulthood in the 60s, the baby boomers. We're the first generation who wanted better communication than our parents had. We went to therapy, and we got to the bottom of the things that tried to keep us from being all that we could be. And now we've hit a new wall, a lack of understanding about menopause and its ramifications and effects. But the sky is still blue and hopeful because there are professionals like you to guide us and help us through. LB: And I love what I do. Perks of being over 40. In a hostage situation, you are likely to be released first. 11. Karen, a 40-year-old experience. I wanted to talk with younger women, those still considering the possibility of having more children. Those for whom menopause is a long, long way down the road, who are burned out because of the superwoman complex. They understandably want it all, but it appears there is a price. To be the perfect wife, the perfect mother, the super successful businesswoman, to have the perfect house, give the perfect dinner parties, volunteer at school, bake cookies for the bake sale, give the perfect business presentations, and on top of it all, be a sex pistol in the sack with her husband at the end of the day, is exhausting, to say the least. There's not enough time in the day, month, or year to be all of the above. As a result, it seems 30- and 40-year-old superwomen are exhausted. It is taking its toll physically and hormonally. Remember that hormone production is blunted by stress. The superwoman's life is so stressful that at the end of the day, there is little to no energy left for sex. I suspect a good night's sleep is the most desirable item on the agenda. Karen's story appears to be typical of what is going on in this age group with women who are super achievers. The surprising information is that the drive and the desire for sex are blunted by exhaustion and the resultant low testosterone and low estrogen that stem from the stress of this overactive lifestyle. Add to that the lists that occupy the superwoman's mind, and it is understandable that something will have gotten off track. Of course, reprioritizing is essential, but in most cases, that is not going to happen. What if hormone replacement could be the magic pill to get these women through this stressful and difficult time? This is Karen's story. I was exalted and exhausted after I finished speaking with her. She is bright and intelligent and has so much going for her, but the quality of her life is impaired by her body's physical inability to keep up, and it is working against her. I am 39 years old. By the time this book is published, I will be 40. I had never given hormones much thought. Like most women, hormones were a mystery to be dealt with down the line. It was all about menopause, which didn't concern me and did not appear to be a particularly pleasant passage, so I thought it was better not to think about it until I had to. The first time hormones became a living, breathing factor in my life was during pregnancy and nursing. It was the first time I realized that I was not in control of my body. It was as though I had lost part of my brain. I've always been so good at math. When out with my girlfriends, I was always the one who could instantly figure the bill, who owed what, factoring in that this one had to fly down so she shouldn't have to pay as much. This would take my brain an instant to decipher. But while pregnant, I couldn't remember a phone number. It was the first time I realized the powerful influence hormones had on my life. When I was pregnant, I had an acute sense of smell. If my husband ate garlic, I had a difficult time sleeping with him. The smell nauseated me, made me really sick to my stomach. It was only in retrospect that I was able to put it all together, that it was hormonal, and that the hormones were in control of my body. Then there was the weight gain that hung around as a new layer, like another whole me, after the baby and throughout the entire 4 years that I nursed both my children. When I was going through it, I just presumed it was environmental, but as soon as I stopped nursing, everything came back into balance. My personality changed during pregnancy also. I became very quiet. My husband would constantly ask if anything was wrong, but I just wasn't aware until looking back on it how inward I had become. It wasn't until afterward that I would think to myself, oh, that's what it was. Once again, another awareness of hormones and that they were not just the concern of menopausal women. There were the physical changes also. After 4 years of nursing, my breasts flattened out. In fact, my 4-year-old started saying, "Mommy, your boobies look like socks." That was pretty depressing, but after about 6 months, they puffed up again. Another hormonal change. My hormone balance was on a roller coaster. I was beginning to realize that hormones were in charge of me physically, mentally, and emotionally. I experienced a severe drop in my sex drive. I had a hormone panel done by my doctor to find out that my lack of libido was due to a complete absence of testosterone. Frankly, I was relieved. I'd been so distraught at my lack of desire, and now I knew it was physiological. My husband would come to me, but it was as though I were looking through a window. I wanted to have those feelings, but they just didn't seem attainable. All of this is so difficult for me. I'm a perfectionist. I want to be the best wife and create the best home for my family. I want to be the best cook and make crafts by hand. I want to be the best mother and prepare pure food for my children and make sure they feel loved and nurtured. When it comes to work, I'm very task-oriented. I can get it all done. Next, bring it on. I love the challenge of watching the business we started grow into something so exciting and successful. Around this same time, my husband and I spent 2 years remodeling our home while living out of boxes in a rental in which we had no interest. It was temporary, and we put our lives on hold while building our dream house. The stress of remodeling, being the perfect mother, starting a new business, running to school with cupcakes for the class, homemade and decorated, of course, and giving the perfect dinner parties was taking its toll. Something didn't feel right. Never did I factor in that I was out of whack hormonally. I just assumed the anxiety was a normal part of everyday existence. One day, I went to the doctor. I have a great cutting-edge doctor who did another hormone panel on me and thought there must have been some mistake because my adrenals were so high. "With numbers this high, you must be a crazy person. You must be bouncing off the walls," he said. "I know it must feel great to be able to race through your day and accomplish so much, but it's going to catch up with you, and you're headed for a big crash." It was a wake-up call, but one I didn't take all that seriously. I had a strange sense of pride that I could do it all. But could I? One evening, my husband asked me for something, and I just blew up at him. It was irrational and emotional, and afterward I felt so bad because I love him so much. I felt terribly guilty that my need for perfection did not leave time for me to be the perfect wife for him. I mean, after my typical frenzied day, how am I supposed to jump in the sack and be the perfect lover? Something's got to give, and it was here that it was caving in. My husband is very understanding. I don't have the same complaints I hear from my other girlfriends. My husband does pitch in. He shares responsibility for the children. He cleans up after dinner, and he's there for me whenever I need something. I began to think, how long will he wait for me to come around? My husband is the picture of health. He's an athlete, so he's in peak physical condition, and on top of that, he's a hunk. How long can my excuses of being overworked and overtired and having too much on my mind remain viable? It makes me feel so sad. I don't know how to fix it. I know it's psychological, but for some reason I can't seem to accept the fact that I have to make some changes. I know I have to get my health on track. I know my hormones are out of whack. Yet it's hard to make the connection that I might need hormone replacement in my life at this time. Somehow, I feel as though I've failed if I have to supplement my hormones at this early age. This scenario is no different from those of any of my girlfriends. They're all complaining that at the end of the day, their busy, frenzied, hectic, overachieving days, the last thing they feel like doing is having sex. One girlfriend refers to it as the dirty little chore, like taking out the garbage. In fact, just yesterday she talked about how she had to take out the garbage last night, ha ha ha. Twice a week she lets him have his way with her to get it over with so that she can finally get some rest. We're all working too much. We all have too much stress and anxiety, and we all have low libido. My sister said to me recently, "It's the ones who make their whole lives about their children who end up alone with their children." I don't want that, but I can see how easily it can happen. I feel so guilty. I know I'm not meeting the needs of my mate. I make feeble attempts to fix it. I went back to my doctor, and he gave me testosterone cream, but it made my skin rough and my face break out. I thought, well, how sexy are pimples? So I stopped using it. My doctor said that obviously the dosage was wrong, but for some reason I didn't pursue getting the right dosage. I know that I'm not eating great. I grab food on the run during the day and take a bite here and a bite there. I know psychologically I'm doing it because I can stay really thin this way. Being thin seems to be overly important, but when you're thin, you look as though everything in your life is going right. I guess I want the outward appearance of my life to look perfect. Thinness does that. Lately, I have started to pad up a little bit. Not a lot, just 5 pounds, but it has me nervous. How can I be gaining weight when I haven't changed my eating? I'm sure at the bottom of it is some other hormonal change. Deep in my heart, I feel that that little perimenopause is peeking its head out of the ground. I know I'm not taking care of myself, and my excuse is that I don't have time. I've started exercising a little, and at the same time I'm putting on a little weight. I can't figure out the connection between the two. I can just feel that my body is beginning to betray me. I need to go to a spa. I need to go away with my husband so that we can just love each other and take care of each other. My husband is so great. He'll do anything to get me in the mood. He'll give me a massage. He'll tell me I'm so hot. He just loves me and my body. He thinks I'm so juicy and great. But I find there just aren't enough hours in the day. It's so important for me to please everybody. I get depressed when I think I'm slipping. I feel guilty when my husband and I go out for the evening, but I also feel guilty if we don't go out for a date. If the kids start acting out, then I feel that I'm letting them down also. Work can overtake my life. I could work 24/7 if I didn't have kids. I had my children later in life. I was in my mid-30s, and the toll on me mentally and emotionally is exhausting. I look at other women who are in their late 40s with children my age, and I think, how do they do it? It is a harder job the older you get. There's only so much energy. It puts the body through so much. When my husband and I do make time for sex, it's so great. It creates a connection between us that lasts throughout the next day. It's the little looks we give each other, that knowing of the intimacy we shared. I want that with my husband always. But life gets in the way. The stresses begin again. My mind gets full of noise. My anxiety increases. And then my hormone production goes wacky again. I'm beginning to understand the connection. I think it's classic with women my age. We have so much to prove, and we want to have it all. It's the superwoman complex, but it's taking its toll on our health and our relationships. I realize that my own self-maintenance is not high on my list. I know I need to get back to my doctor, but this time I'm going to follow his program. He's been offering it to me, but I've been too busy to hear. It's a big commitment. I have to make some serious changes in my life to protect all that I value. I don't know why I am not at the top of my list. I don't know what drives me. It's such a cliche, but we all need to clone ourselves. The other day was so classic me. I had to go to a mother-daughter tea at 2 o'clock, and at 1:30 I was at a boutique hurriedly buying an outfit. I pulled it off and I looked rather nice, but when I looked down at my feet in my new open-toed shoes, my toes were in bad need of a pedicure. I wanted to curl those things into my shoes because now all I could see were my feet, which were in such need of some tender, loving care. Instead of giving myself credit for getting to the tee at all with my schedule, I obsessed about my toes. That's my perfectionism driving me again. I get depressed because it's all too much. I am aware that the stress is damaging me physically. I know I'm not there for my beautiful husband. It's as though I'm watching him go somewhere and I'm not on that train with him. I have to get back on that pace with him. I don't want to end up this old haggard wife with the hot husband. My marriage and my relationship with my husband are so important. I have to start making us a priority. I'm going back to my doctor. I'm going to do it this time. I'm hearing myself talk, and it's clear to me that I am the problem. It's me, and it's my hormones. I need my doctor to help get my life back on track. It's a lot of work, but if I don't do it and something happens to me, this whole thing I've worked so hard to create will crumble. What good is the perfect house with the perfect children and the fabulous business without the stuff of life? Contentment, relaxation, fun. I have forgotten about fun. I'm so busy being perfect that I have forgotten that life is to be enjoyed and to have fun. I have to work on the addiction of work. I'm addicted to adrenaline. I love being busy. I'm stimulated when I have 100 things going at once. But at what price? If ever anything were to happen to my marriage, I would look back and remember when it started. The bitchy times, the short-tempered times, those fly-off-the-handle moments. These are the destructive things that break down the best of things. I used to look at my sister and think, what's wrong with you? She was such a perfectionist. Now, I've become her. I have to work at this. I hope my story helps women in the same position. I never realized how serious this whole scenario had become until I started talking about it. We have to help one another. It will take a shift in my thinking, a reevaluation of my priorities, a realistic look at what I want, and how can I have it all without sacrificing that which means the most to me. I want to get my life back on track. We women are mirrors for one another. Maybe, by seeing my chicken with her head cut off existence, someone else will realize how crazy it all is. To think it all might start coming together with a dose of testosterone. Karen, a follow-up. I'm happy to report that before this book went to print, I spoke with Karen again. She called me to let me know that she really had made getting well a priority in her life. She went back to the doctor and had a full hormone panel run. Not only was she practically zeroed out on testosterone, but her estrogen was at half the level it should be for her age, and her progesterone was also low. Her doctor prescribed natural bioidentical hormones in the form of creams. She's been on a low dose for the last 3 months and has this to report. I can't tell you the difference this has made in my life. Within a couple of weeks, I could see and feel the difference. Those extra few pounds I had started to carry began melting off. Finally, my body was responding when I was eating right and exercising. There's such frustration when you're doing what you're supposed to be doing and you're still not getting results. The hormones did the trick. But perhaps the greatest improvement is my mood. I'm better able to handle the normal everyday stressors that come my way. My temper is much better, and I don't sweat the small stuff. Before getting my hormones balanced, you could have told me all day, "Don't worry about it." But my feelings were real and could not be discounted. My husband and I started seeing a counselor just to protect what we have created. We made some headway, but once I started the hormones, we ran out of things to discuss. Our sex life has also improved. It's not yet back to full speed, but I've initiated it a couple of times. My doctor told me that he has a therapist who sends patients his way from time to time. Once he balances their hormones, they usually stop the therapy. That's how powerful our hormones are to our everyday lives. Thank you, Suzanne, from the bottom of my heart, for encouraging me to seek out these answers for myself. I have such a leg up on the next passage that will come my way. I plan to stay balanced and follow your lead. I love my cream. It's my happy cream, and I can't thank you enough for helping me to see that taking care of myself is the best way to take care of my husband, my children, and even my business. With much love, from a not-quite-cured perfectionist, but at least a much happier one. Perks of being over 40. Your investment in health insurance is finally beginning to pay off. 12. Dr. Jennifer Berman, female sexual dysfunction. Dr. Jennifer Berman is one of the few female urologists in the United States with specialized training in female urology and female sexual dysfunction. Sexual dysfunction is an embarrassing and uncomfortable condition, and there are very few places a woman can go to find answers. Dr. Berman provides a great service in a comfortable and safe environment. She's also written a book with her sister, Dr. Laura Berman, see Chapter 10, called For Women Only. At some point, most women will experience some sort of sexual dysfunction, usually because of hormonal imbalance, but until recently, it has never been given any importance because women are still able to function even if they don't feel anything. I asked her, "What percentage of women in this country are unfulfilled sexually and why?" JB: I guess that would really depend on what range you're talking about, but overall, anywhere between 30 to 50% of American women have complained of sexual dysfunction at some time in their lives. SS: What are the reasons? JB: The reasons are multifaceted and can range from emotional, relational, and psychological issues all the way to hormonal, medical, and surgical. SS: What are the most common complaints? JB: The most common complaint that women relate to their sexual dysfunction is low desire. Again, the reasons for that can be medical and/or physical, but often it's a combination of the two. Even if the original problem is physical, emotional and relational problems can result, and vice versa. If a woman comes in because her relationship is in crisis and she's not satisfied with her marriage, frequently we'll find that there is also a hormonal problem or some medication that she is on or has been on in her medical history. SS. What is the average age of your patients? JB. The average age of the women I see in my practice is 45, so they are perimenopausal, but I also see older women and menopausal women. Problems begin around the age of 45, but some women will start to notice things about themselves in their late 30s and early 40s. My mission is to inform and educate women about the potential changes that can happen so they can be in tune with their bodies. SS. How does a woman know when she's in menopause? A lot of the same symptoms are present when a woman experiences PMS or perhaps is just having a bad day. JB. Very often, women will start to experience changes in their hormones, whether it's irritability or not sleeping as well, or that their memory is not quite what it used to be. They may experience vaginal dryness, low libido, lack of sexual response, and a lack of feeling in the genital area. Most often, the problems are due to subtle, if not dramatic, changes in hormones, but I cannot say 100% that this is the reason all women experience problems. There can be other emotional relationship factors, and a woman will say, I feel tired, I feel like I have low desire, I feel like I don't respond very well. Yet when she's on vacation in the Caribbean without the kids, just she and her husband, everything is fine. For her problem to be defined as hormonal, it has to cross through all situations and be persistent and pervasive. SS. Is stress a major factor? JB. Stress is a major factor affecting women and their sexual lives, and for that matter, their emotional and physical lives also. Stress affects hormones. Stress in women can lower testosterone levels and cause libido problems and sleep problems. But sexual problems can also be caused by surgeries that result in nerve damage, such as in a tubal ligation. There's very little data in the medical literature to support this theory, but women would tell me that after they had their tubal ligation, they noticed their libido and their orgasms changed. I'm not saying there's any science to support this, but we are definitely hearing this repeatedly from women. SS. Are women experiencing lack of libido only in the case of tubal ligations, or would other surgeries cause the same thing? JB. Any pelvic surgeries that impact blood flow and nerve supply to the genital area can affect a woman's sexual drive, including hysterectomy, removal of the uterus and/or the ovaries, bladder surgery, or colon surgery. SS. That is frightening. I've never given a thought to the fact that any type of pelvic or uterine surgery would have an impact on my sex drive. JB. Many doctors still do not understand the dangers inherent to nerve and blood flow to the genital area during an episiotomy, which is a taken-for-granted procedure in childbirth. There are now different philosophies on the benefit of this procedure. Is it better to have a natural tear, or is it better to have a surgical straight tear? An episiotomy incision can definitely cause pain problems that will affect women throughout their lives. They come in and need revisions of their episiotomy scars or other surgical repairs, so it is important for women to know that these procedures can cause pain and nerve damage down the road. SS. Did you start out wanting to specialize in women's sexual dysfunction? JB. Yes, but when I first started my practice, I thought sexual problems would primarily be the domain of aging and menopausal women. Now that I'm immersed in this field, I'm finding that younger women are experiencing sexual problems as well, and that is most often due to hormones. Even very young women in their 20s who are on birth control pills will and can experience libido problems and vaginal dryness, and they have no idea what is wrong with them. They go to their doctors and are told it's all in their heads. The birth control pills alter their hormones, and this is where the difficulty occurs. Often in their mid to late 30s, women experience testosterone deficiency syndrome, especially after having babies. It happens sometimes after the first baby, but more often after the second baby. Women will come in and say, "Life is great. I've got health. The kids are in school." but I still have this loss of desire and a dramatic change in feeling sexual. It just does not make sense that it is all because I'm stressed and tired. In testing, I have found that they do in fact have low testosterone levels and do respond to testosterone. Some young women also have changes in their estrogen levels. So we now realize that after a first or second child, a woman's testosterone levels can drop so much that they need testosterone replacement forever. There's also a drop in progesterone levels, but that is temporary. There are dramatic fluctuations in a woman's hormones after delivery.